This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. Today we start with a story from the July 1984 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is 300 South Montgomery by Jean O'Neill. Moving stiffly, the heavy mist like a fallen cloud, light distorted, images blurred, sounds sharp but dislocated, strange, surreal, yet not really frightening, almost comforting like a cloak of gauze, soft, protective. Slowly, the stiffness eases from limbs, movement smoothing to an effortless glide. Then, suddenly, far ahead in the mist, a doorway of light, framing a woman, her face clear and distinct, highlighted by a silvery beam. Features, a cascade of black hair with a silvery dab in front, high cheekbones polished rose pink and full lips forming a wide smile. And her hand, the long, graceful fingers, making a beckoning gesture. But the door swinging shut. Run, faster, faster, hurry. The outstretched hand, heart pounding, lungs gasping, just another step now. The lights blink out at the closed door, pounding furiously, pounding the cold numbers. 300. No, no, K, K, K. Neil McCarthy awakened from his dream, his head throbbing with pain. He reached across the bed, his fingers frantically clawing the crumpled sheet. Numbly, he stared at the empty half-bed, the undented pillow. K. Then he groaned as reality dawned. His wife was gone, killed in the car accident 5 months ago, coming home from the Christmas party. He closed his eyes and breathed deeply, overcome by his guilt. But she wasn't really gone. No. Neil felt her presence so near, always so near. If only there were a way to reach her. Jesus, he whispered hoarsely. Let go, man, let go. It was only a damn dream. Kate and the numbers. She was gone and he was sick. He forced his eyes open, focusing on the digital clock on the nightstand. 7:10 a.m. The figures blurred as he realized he was going to be late for work. But still, he was unable to move, paralyzed by the sense of his wife's nearness and his pounding head, the loose, queasy feeling deep in his gut. Maybe I'll call in sick, Neil thought, reaching for the phone beside the clock. But his hand halted in midair, halfway to the phone. No, he'd called in yesterday, and twice last week. Shit, he thought, his hand sagging to the side of the bed. Then, with an effort of will, Neil sat upright and swung his legs out of bed. Ignoring the fresh wave of nausea, he stood up and stumbled across the room. He steadied himself against the chair and pulled on his postal uniform trousers, the effort sending slivers of pain into his skull. For a moment he remained motionless, afraid he was going to throw up, but after several deep breaths, the nausea eased and he shambled into the closet. Unable to find a clean shirt, he returned to the chair and bent over to pick up the wrinkled shirt off the floor. Feeling lightheaded and dizzy, he sagged to a kneeling position. Again, he breathed slowly and evenly, and after a moment he was able to stand. He slipped on the shirt and headed for the kitchen. Jerking open the fridge door, he found a can of Bud. With trembling fingers, he popped off the top and drained the beer in two long swallows. Then, as an afterthought, he searched through the junk drawer and found two Excedrin. He took them, drinking from the faucet over the sink. Feeling slightly better, he shaved and left the apartment. Neil nodded as he rushed past the two clerks smoking on the loading dock behind the main post office. He pushed through the set of swinging freight doors and cut across the main floor, past the rows of parcel post tubs to the time clock. He felt a glimmer of hope as he punched in and glanced at the desk of the supervisor of carriers. 7:33, only 3 minutes late, and Danberg had his back turned, checking the assignment board. Maybe I can just ease by, Neil thought hopefully. But Danberg turned before Neil could sneak by, a scowl etched on the supervisor's heavy features. McCarthy, you're late, Danberg said, his high-pitched nasal tone at odds with his huge frame. He shook his head, disgust replacing the scowl. Did you sleep in that shirt? No, I... Neil stammered. He brushed at the front of his wrinkled shirt, his head throbbing again. Unable to think clearly, he mumbled an apology for being late. Sorry. Danberg almost choked. Looking furious, he shuffled through a short stack of papers on his desk, finally finding a letter. He held it up in a beefy hand and said, "This is for you, from the postmaster, a letter of warning." Neil's stomach turned, the slivers of pain in his head making dots dance before his eyes. Jesus, he was sick. He reached for the letter, but the supervisor jerked it back out of reach. Face growing even redder, Danberg said, "Uh-uh, you're late enough as it is. Go on to your case. I'll see you later." Still holding the letter, he turned back to the assignment board to study the various route numbers and assigned carrier names. Too sick to argue, Neil stumbled away from Danberg's desk, moving along the row of blue carrier's cases, stopping at his route, City 21. Jesus, I should have said something to the big asshole, he thought, feeling angry and humiliated. Hey, Mac the Gun, Ray Lewis said, backing out of his case, City 20. The tall black man was an old friend. They'd played City League basketball together for years. Neil firing up the outside bombs, Ray doing the rebounding and inside work. But that had been last year, before the accident. Better get hot, man, Ray suggested good-naturedly, gesturing at Neil's case. There's a shit pot of mail. Say, you okay, Mac? The smile disappeared from the black man's face. You look kind of frayed around the edges. Neil forced a grin. I'm fine, Ray, just fine. Late start, skip breakfast, you know. Ray nodded. Yeah, I dig. He patted Neil's shoulder and moved back into his case. Well, hang in there, man, hang in. Nodding to himself, Neil stepped into his own case. In front of him, the six rows of numbered slots for letter-sized mail swam before his eyes, the color-coded streets blurred into a kaleidoscope whirl, 550 different addresses arranged in order of delivery, and later 11 miles of walking to deliver it. Neil shook his head, feeling weary. He couldn't do it, not this morning, not today, but he knew he had no choice. Danberg and the letter, Danberg the prick. A rush of anger partially revived Neil. No, he couldn't risk any more time off, sick or whatever. That's probably what the letter of warning was about, he guessed, glancing down at the mail lined up on his desk ledge. 4 feet of letters. No, too many years invested. Jesus, he sighed, looking left at his flat case, full of magazines and other flats thrown the day before. And to his right, the back of Ray's flat case. His stomach muscles knotted as he fought off the feeling of claustrophobia in the tiny cubicle. I am trapped, he thought, closing his eyes. Kay in the doorway, smiling, beckoning. So real, so near. Neil blinked and focused on the tiny case numbers. Biting down on his lower lip, Neil repeated Ray's advice. Hang in there. Hang in there. He picked up a handful of mail, and slowly he began to throw letters into the case. 295 South Hartson, Jay's Drugs, 104 South Seymour. Wait a minute, he murmured to himself, noticing the name on the letter. Johansson. Yeah, that's a forward, he reminded himself, placing the letter aside, to be sent to the forwarding computer in Oakland. As he continued to work, he felt himself slipping into the old, familiar rhythm of it, throwing the letters into their proper slots, placing the forwards aside. Bip, 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 plunk, bip. Suddenly, Neil stopped. He stared at an address on a small letter. Resident, 300 South Montgomery. No such number, he thought. South Montgomery didn't even have a 300 block. He tapped the letter on the case between 298 and 402 South Montgomery, where the missing 300 should have been. It wasn't uncommon to get a non-existent block. Maybe they meant 300 South Hartson or 300 South Seymour. Whatever, Neil thought, scribbling no such number, C21, on the letter. Then he set it aside to take to the throwback case later. But something about the piece of mail destroyed his rhythm, stirring a vague feeling of apprehension. He rested for a moment, closing his eyes. The closed door and the numbers 300. He blinked, wondering what it all meant, if anything. Maybe it's just the booze, he thought. I'm going around the bend. He shook his head, feeling sheepish. Still, the vague feeling lingered. At 11:10, Neil was the last carrier to tie out his route. Dan Berg had been by three times, grumbling under his breath, and finally, after pushing the tub of mail and parcels out back, Neil loaded his Jeep and left the post office. He decided to stop for lunch before starting his route. At the Circle K near South Seymour, Neil parked his Jeep. He ate a ham sandwich and drank two beers. By noon, his headache had almost disappeared and his stomach was settled. He climbed back into the Jeep and delivered the first of his route, parking and looping South Seymour and South Hartson. Then he moved the vehicle to 102 South Montgomery for the next relay. After loading the flats and two bundles of mail into his carrying bag, Neil checked the back of the Jeep for parcels. Nothing for South Montgomery. He slipped the rubber band from the first bundle of letters and began working his way up the street, thumb through the mail, check for flats, drop it off, go to the next house, another rhythmic cycle. His mind drifted to K, the dream, the number on the door, and the strange letter today. At the end of the second block, he cut the lawn at 298. Neil stopped suddenly, as if he'd run into an invisible wall. Silver was out, the big German shepherd lying on the porch. "Easy, boy, easy," he whispered, backing away carefully from the huge dog. The shepherd stood up, the silver hair bristling along its neck, its black eyes watching Neil. Then it growled, a dry rasp from deep in its throat, barely audible but full of menace, and began slowly creeping down the stairs, its eyes unwavering. "Jesus," Neil swore, reaching for the can of dog spray at his side. "Easy, boy," he repeated in a hoarse voice, shaking the small can. "That's a good boy," he added, moving his carrying bag in front of himself like a shield. The dog hesitated for a moment, watching Neil shake the can. Then it dropped into a crouch. "Silver!" Mrs. Jones shouted, banging open the front screen door. "Get in here!" Almost instantly, the big dog turned and ran up the steps, disappearing into the house. "Sorry," the elderly woman said, wiping her hands on a red-checked apron. "I was making strawberry jam. Forgot he was out. But Silver won't bite." She moved down the steps. "Got anything for here?" Neil nodded, his legs rubbery. He handed the woman a letter and a sunset. She took the mail, thanked him, and followed the dog back through the screen door. Neil swallowed hard, glued to the spot. He knew he was typical of most carriers, leery of all dogs, scared shitless of the big ones. And Mrs. Jones was typical, too. Her dog wouldn't bite. Yet, 28,000 carriers a year were bitten. After a few moments, Neil moved stiffly to the corner of South Montgomery and Spruce, a busy intersection. Still shaken by the confrontation with Silver, he stood at the curb for a minute, idly watching the cars blow by. The dull headache had returned. He closed his eyes, taking a deep breath. The door, and the numbers 300. He snapped his eyes open as a Kawasaki roared by. Stepping off the curb, Neil smiled. If there had been a 300 South Montgomery, it would be here, in the middle of busy Spruce Street. Still smiling, he crossed the street and thumbed through the mail for 402 South Montgomery. But he couldn't shake the lingering sense of unease stirred by the image of the door in the dream and the association with the bum piece of mail, and his head throbbed. As usual, after work, Neil stopped at Jack's Club. After three double vodkas, he felt much better. In the cool darkness, the tension eased from his body as he listened to the jukebox. Rose-colored glasses, he recognized the twangy, old man voice of John Connolly, one of his favorite Western singers. The music completed the restoration. His headache was gone. Suddenly, light reflected in the mirror over the bar. Neil looked up and saw a woman framed in the doorway. Long dark hair, high cheekbones, a full smile. Jesus, he gasped to himself, setting down his drink. He stared unbelievably. Then the others crowded in behind the woman, and Neil realized she was too young, too short to be Kay. But for a minute there, he sighed deeply and with a trembling hand picked up the glass and drained it. He signaled Jack for a refill, staring at himself in the mirror. Jesus, boy, you look like hell, he told himself, his gaze dropping to the crumpled postal uniform shirt. He tried to smooth out the wrinkles with his hand, remembering how neat Kay had been about his clothes, a fresh shirt to work every day. His face felt warm, and he swallowed, trying to clear the lump in his throat. Ignoring the fresh drink, Neil tossed a couple of bills on the bar, decided to go home and do some laundry. At the corner, near the apartment, Neil stopped at the 7-Eleven. He picked up a box of detergent, a can of chili, some tortilla chips, and a 12-pack of Bud. Then he drove around behind the apartment to his stall. Before he could get out, he heard someone shouting his name. Mac! Mac! Hey! Hey, Mac! It was his friend Billy, riding up on his big wheels. Hey, what do you say, pal? Neil asked, stumbling as he climbed out of the car. He set the bag of groceries down on the dented hood of the Pinto, realizing he was beginning to feel the drinks. Hi, Mac, the 5-year-old boy repeated breathlessly. Guess what? Neil raised his eyebrows and shrugged, almost laughing at the boy's obvious excitement. Don't know. B&W had kittens in the laundry room this morning, right in Mrs. Semmer's basket. Neil laughed, picturing the apartment busybody's face. Then he asked, B&W? The boy nodded. You know, Jackie's cat. Oh, yeah, Neil said, controlling his glee. I bet Mrs. Seminara was surprised. Billy frowned. She got mad, told Jackie's mom, but the frown dissolved into a smile. Jackie says I can have a kitty when they're bigger. That's great. Let's celebrate. Neil pulled out the bag of tortilla chips and offered some to Billy, remembering the first time he'd seen the boy, about a year ago. Billy was riding his big wheel at the time, around noon on a Sunday, wearing a pajama top but no bottom, crap running down his leg, and his big eyes bright and shiny, even though he'd eaten nothing since dinner the night before. Neil had taken him upstairs to Kay, and they'd cleaned the boy up, fed him, and played with him for an hour or so, until his mother Sandy had got up and come looking for her son. Jesus, Kay had loved kids, but they never had any. Neil rubbed his numb face, closed his eyes. The doorway of light, framing a woman. Hey, Mac, can I have some more? The boy was tugging at Neil's pants pocket. Well, I think it's dinner time, pal, Neil answered, roughing up the boy's hair. Billy shrugged, then his face brightened. Thanks for sesame. Neil hoisted the boy up on his shoulders, then picked up the bag of groceries. "You'll be carrying me soon, bub." Billy giggled, bouncing up and down as Neil climbed the apartment steps. Stumbling, Neil realized he was slightly drunk. At Billy's door, he dropped the grocery bag, set the boy down, and rapped twice. Sandy answered, "Hi, Mac." Billy scooted past his mother, headed for the TV set. "Figured it was about dinner time for the boy," Neil said slowly, carefully keeping the slur from his voice. He bent over and picked up the grocery bag. Sandy nodded. "Swanson's macaroni and cheese." Neil shifted the bag. "Guess you had some excitement in the laundry room today." "Yeah," Sandy answered, chuckling. "Freaked out old lady Seminara." They laughed together, sharing delight in the busybody's misfortune. After the glee died, they stood quietly, the silence growing awkward. Finally, "Be nice for Billy," the woman said. "The kitten, I mean." "Yeah, pets are good for kids," Neil agreed, his face feeling stiff, his tongue thick. "Well, I better go." Before he could move, Sandy reached out and brushed his arm, a soft, intimate caress. "Thanks, Mac, for being so good to Billy." He nodded. "Maybe we could get together sometime, you know?" Neil knew, and he was tempted. Sandy was kinda pretty, especially her braided hair. Irish setter auburn, and her eyes faded denim, almost the exact color of Kay's. He looked away, afraid to think. "Yeah, maybe sometime," he whispered huskily. He shifted the grocery bag again. "Well, I've got to do some laundry now." He didn't even try to hide the slur in his voice. They stood silent for another moment, then the woman smiled. "Yeah, and I've got to put on the oven. See you, Mac." He waved goodbye with his empty hand as she disappeared back into the apartment. For a few seconds, he stood staring at her door, at the rusty number 4 hanging upside down. Then, slowly, he turned and climbed the stairs, feeling 100 years old. Later that night, after the laundry, a plate of warm chili and half a dozen beers, Neil sat in his shorts staring at an old movie on TV, Treasure of the Sierra Madre. It had had a cult following when Neil was going to junior college. Humphrey Bogart, Tim Holt, Walter Houston, and the Mexican actor Alfonso Bedoya. The sound was turned down, and Neil stared at the flickering images, brooding, Kay, the dream, the door, and number 300, and the letter for 300 South Montgomery. "Something strange here," he thought. Then he sat upright, remembering another cult at junior college. Kay had them over to the apartment once. A religious group? Something about the power of number combinations? Damn, he couldn't remember. It had all been mumbo-jumbo magic to him. But Kay had believed it. Jesus, maybe she was trying to reach out to him with numbers. But why 300? He rubbed his eyes, his head buzzing from the beer and booze. Nah. He forced the crazy crap from his head, focusing back on the TV. The movie was drawing to a close, Bogart leading the mules towards the Mexican village. Neil drained another bud, dropping the empty beer can onto the pile of crumpled empties beside the chair. His face felt numb, like after a visit to the dentist. He blinked, mouthing Bedoya's classic line to Bogart. "Hey, don't I know you?" Unsteadily, Neil rose and moved close to the little screen. The bandits were slicing open the sacks of gold, letting the coarse, sand-like dust trickle out and swirl away in the desert wind. Neil slapped off the TV before the dumb anticlimax. That night, he had the dream again. The next morning, Neil was hung over again, his hand so shaky he couldn't sheave, even after drinking a can of Bud. In the kitchen, he held his breath, and with two hands holding the glass, he drank a generous slug of vodka. The raw liquor burned his throat, making him retch, but he kept it down, and in a few minutes a warmness spread from his stomach into his arms and legs, calming the tremor in his hands. Later, after Neil had punched in, Danberg signaled for him to stop at the supervisor's desk. Then the big man announced loudly in his shrill voice, "The postmaster got a call from Mrs. Gary on South Hartson." Neil winced. The Garys lived at 102 and were constant complainers. "Well," Danberg continued, glancing at a note, "she says you did not pick up her outgoing mail yesterday." He held up a beefy hand, interrupting Neil's explanation. "I called her yesterday afternoon, and I explained that a carrier was not obligated to pick up outgoing mail when he had nothing to deliver. But she said you regularly leave outgoing, even after dropping off mail. She says it's a feud with you since she called in last December. Now, McCarthy, we're a service organization." Danberg's face was squeezed up into a super-serious expression, as though he were lecturing a dull boy about life or death. "And a carrier is a service person. If we don't provide service, then we're out of business. We'll all be on the beach permanent." Of course, it was all bullshit. The lecture about service, management really cared only about production, loading the carriers down with circulars every day, and the complaint. Neil felt the anger tightening his throat. Mrs. Gary enjoyed taking one mistake and making it an everyday occurrence. She could point the finger, somehow making her feel superior or something. Damn it. Neil swore silently. He'd made a real effort, even picking up letters when she had no mail, at least when he wasn't sick. The bitch. He felt dizzy, his legs weak. Danberg was standing silent, staring at Neil, waiting. Finally, Neil sighed and nodded as if he'd listened to the whole lecture and understood. Danberg waved him away. In front of his case, Neil saw Ray Lewis shaking his head, an angry expression on the black man's face. "Hey, man," Ray said, "don't pay that fool no mind. Everybody know he don't know duck shit." They stepped into their individual cases, Ray still talking, but the angry tone dissolving. Neil picked up a handful of letters. "No. Well, he's pulling the plug next month." Neil paused. "Alvin Thompson retiring? He carried City 5 down at the First Street branch office. Jesus, that meant City 5 would be up for bid." "That's right," Jay said, as if reading Neil's mind. "And 5's mostly driving. Rural boxes and apartments with gang boxes, only 2 short walking relays in Quail Trailer Park, no dogs, and best of all, you can kiss your buddy Danberg bye-bye." Despite his headache, Neil smiled. Ray knew he wanted off City 21. Maybe he would bid Thompson's route. He probably had enough seniority to get the bid. "Hey, Mac, you get 5, you'll need a one-sleeved raincoat," J.A. said, chuckling, his good humor returning. Neil shook his head at the old post office joke. On a mounted route, all that ever got wet during bad weather was one arm. "Say, what about the fog?" Ray added. "Weird, huh? Like the stuff in them English monster flicks. Streets'll be slicker than old Gaylord Sinker." "Yeah," Nick agreed, recalling Ray's outrage when the Giants traded away Gaylord Perry, the infamous spitball pitcher. Unusual spring weather. Sometime during the night, the fog had eased over the coastal mountains, filling the valley. Neil stopped casing, staring at the address of the resident, 300 South Montgomery. At first, he thought it was another piece of mail. But no, it was the same piece from yesterday. There was his notation in the corner. No such number, City 21. He turned the letter over and picked up a slight scent. Familiar. He hadn't noticed it yesterday. He held the letter close and sniffed. Jesus, it couldn't be her scent. And why had the clerks thrown it back? An impulse, Neil flipped the letter into the right side of 298 South Montgomery's slot. where the missing 300 blocks should be. He knew it was silly, yet after he put the letter up, he felt a sense of relief, like he had done the right thing. He left it in the case. After delivering South Hartson, Neil rested for a minute at his Jeep. He felt weak and a little sick. He rubbed his face and looked around. The fog had almost burned off, but the streets remained wet and slippery, just like Ray Lewis's forecast. Neil got back in his Jeep and eased it over to the low end of South Montgomery. Putting the relay in his carrying bag, he thought again about Alvin Thompson's route. Probably wasn't a mile of walking. And Danberg, yeah, his mind was made up. A change would be good. Maybe he could ease up on the booze, let go of Kay. With a grunt, he hoisted the bag onto his shoulder, then began working the street. As he moved up the 200 block, the mist seemed to thicken, stirring a feeling of déjà vu, a sense of nervous anticipation. Then Neil slowed his pace, remembering the confrontation with Silver the day before. He thumbed the mail and signed with relief. Nothing for 298. He wouldn't have to stop at the Joneses. Maybe he could use the fog as cover and slip by, even if the damn dog was out. He kept off the sidewalk, tiptoeing across the Joneses' lawn, peering left, watching for the dog, his throat dry, his heart thumping against his ribs. A sound raised the hair on the back of Neil's neck. A metallic jingle? He wasn't sure. He stopped, cocked his head, and listened. There, faint but discernible, the jingle of a dog collar. Jesus! He swallowed, trying to work up moisture in his dry mouth, and he squeezed the can of dog spray at his side, trying to draw some comfort from the tiny pseudo-weapon. Sweat trickled down his ribs. Several seconds ticked by, but nothing appeared. Maybe he'd imagined the jingle, Neil told himself, or maybe it wasn't Silver after all. Still, he remained rooted in place, half expecting something to materialize in the fog. Only silence, grating silence. Where was that damn dog? Finally, listening intently, Neil forced himself to move on to the corner of Spruce. For a moment, he just stood on the curb, trying to relax. He'd been so tense, his stomach muscles ached. He waited, letting his pulse slow. But there was something else. His gaze was drawn to the top letter on his mail bundle. Resident, 300 South Montgomery. Jesus, he'd forgotten about the letter. His vision blurred and he felt dizzy, overwhelmed by a strong sense of déjà vu. The fog swirled, thickened about him like a fallen cloud. He shivered with the recognition. He was standing in his own dream. The mist seemed so soft, protective, like gauze. Gradually, his stiffness eases, and he moves smoothly a few steps. Suddenly, far ahead in the mist, a rectangle of light, a doorway, framing a woman, her hair focused clearly in a beam of silvery light. Features, a cascade of black hair with a silvery dab in front, the high cheekbones polished rose pink and lips forming a full smile, her hand, the long, graceful fingers, making a beckoning gesture. He moves towards the doorway, and the woman, a deep-throated half-cough, half-growl, a distant sound chilling. Again, somewhere far left of the doorway, an unnatural sound. Then something large and heavy moving swiftly towards him. The raspy cough-growl again, this time louder, nearer, run towards the doorway. Couch's outstretched hand, faster, faster. But there, cutting in front of him, a shadow, features blurred, a huge head and bared fangs, shiny eyes glowing like banked coals. And the creature is closing in, blocking him from Kay. No, no, something snaps in his head. Then a tingling as a feeling of tremendous power spreads out from his chest, down his arms to his fingertips, and a sound stirs deep in his throat, welling up, bursting from his lips, a cry that slashes the stillness like a razor, then rage, murderous rage, overwhelming him. He bends low and pounces on the creature, the thing twisting and struggling furiously to escape. But he locks his grip and squeezes, crushes, until the thing slumps slowly, limply. Then he raises it overhead and slams it down with tremendous force, his heart pounding now, lungs gasping. He moans, a high-pitched squealing and two fuzzy orbs dancing into him. Blackness. Dimly, Neil sees three people bending over him. Strangers, their voices faint, distant. My God, he's breathing. Call an ambulance. Footsteps running, fading. Did you see him in the middle of the street? I couldn't stop. He's a postman. I couldn't stop. Good God, look what he did to that shepherd. Neil tries to signal them with his eyes. The letter, it was from him, and he wasn't in the middle of Spruce, no. They fade, blurring in the mist, and above the strangers he sees a doorway, and the numbers, 300. It opens, and Kay reaches down, taking his hand, her grip, so warm, so smooth, and she's smiling. He feels himself being pulled up, 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 effortlessly, like a balloon floated away, up, up through the doorway, and the silvery light caresses him, warming his chilled, broken body. What's he grasping? A letter addressed to resident, 300 South Montgomery. We continue with a story from the December 1983 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Busby by Harvey Jacobs. The first expedition to the planet Busby noticed the incredible profusion of foliage. The second expedition documented the marvelous vegetables that grew there, their quantity, their quality, their wonderful taste. The third expedition determined that there was nothing special about the climate of Busby, nor the generic makeup of its plants, flowers, and edibles. The lush growth was attributed to a soil additive. After extensive research, it was discovered that the additive was nothing more than the normal evacuations of Busbians, who had the habit of relieving themselves whenever and wherever they felt the urge. Their droppings were the difference. Since Busby was considered of the seventh world, i.e., in a most primitive phase of development, the Galactic Council decided on a special fate for the planet. Its inhabitants were to be nurtured like privileged pets and fed copious amounts of food. A large percentage of Busbian emissions were to be collected through the use of a very elaborate and costly sewage system, then processed and shipped to the developed orbs, where they would be used to stimulate crop production. The plan took time, since it required a certain amount of Busbian rethink, but ultimately it worked splendidly. The great advertising firm of Savage, Gossamer, and Levine Limited was hired first to teach the Busbians to formalize their movements, i.e. to use gathering huts. Second, the Busbians had to be encouraged to eat and eat and eat. Since they were intelligent creatures, they could not be force-fed like French geese. Their consumption was necessarily a matter of open choice. The free markets, like the gathering huts, had to be sold to the Busbians, who were familiar with a hunting and fishing economy. Savage, Gossamer, and Levine succeeded marvelously with the cooperation of Galaxy Central. Laws were passed to strictly regulate Busby media. Nothing thin was permissible. Even, or especially the art galleries, which managed to survive on Busby, could display only flaccid nudes. The idea that fat was beautiful was communicated quickly and effectively to the receptive population. Excessive movement was discouraged. Thus, the Busbians ate and drank, embraced a passive culture, and produced incredible amounts of Busby grow for export. Savage, Gossamer, and Levine received the coveted Class 1 Clio Award for a job well done. Naturally, Busby was held in supreme contempt by the more civilized planets. Busby jokes were part of every comic's patter. "I've got to Busby" became an accepted, even universal expression. Since the Busbians did not know any of this, it didn't bother them. They got free food, free drink, around-the-clock TV service, splendid housing, and fine medical care. All they had to do in return was what they would have done without any of those highly desirable perks. On Busby, the people made jokes about their customers who snapped up bushels of Busby grow as fast as they could be packaged. On Busby, they thumbed magazines filled with erotic pictures of the chubby gorgeous, read books in which enormous men and women triumphed over the skimpy, and saw programs whose ratings seemed determined by the tonnage of the cast. On Busby, they were happy enough. Now, it came to pass that Savage, Gossamer, and Levine, while still number one in the advertising universe, having parlayed its success with Project Busby to attract a blue-chip client list, became engaged in a rivalry with an upstart agency, Thrust Associates. Thrust Associates succeeded in signing some prestigious accounts, and the industry sensed its momentum. The creative director for Thrust woke up one morning with an inspiration for a new campaign. The client was a company that sold diet aids. The creative director phoned Bradford Thomas, one of his trustworthy writers. "Brad, are you awake enough to hear what I have to say?" Yes, I think so, if the damn birds don't drown you out." "What birds? You live in the city." "Right. It's not the birds, it's the plumbing. The plumbing chirps. What the hell time is it?" "Don't matter. Listen, are you ready for this? We do the commercial for Slendorable on Busby." "You must be crazy. First of all, it's impossible. Second, it's illegal. Third, it's fabulous. Fabulous." "I knew you'd erupt to the idea, Brad. Let's take a meeting. This could be big." "Big is right. I mean, big is wrong. You know what I mean. Hey, did you hear that pipe sing? It does that every morning. Lord, I love my life." Bradford Thomas found himself on a transport ship 1 month later, headed for Busby. Along with him was Derek Lane, a filmmaker of enormous reputation, Hanson Brodovich, a sound engineer, and Cookie Fountain, the most beautiful model on planet Earth, a former Ms. Dipper. They carried forged credentials, which proclaimed that they were part of the ship's crew. The transport was a gigantic tanker filled with sour cream, bananas, a variety of custards, and a million assorted pastries. It was, of course, designed to return with a shipment of Busby grow, with a cargo turning around time of 6 hours. The trip to Busby took 20 24-hour days, so there was time for conceptual development. Brad Thompson, Derek Lane, Hanson Brodovich, and Cookie Fountain spent endless hours discussing their shoot. The temptations aboard the transport were hard to resist. The men ate like horses. Cookie Fountain could force herself to regurgitate like an ancient Roman, so she ate too. The plan was simple. They would use equipment so compact as to be unnoticeable. They would set up outside Busby Stadium. The favorite and only certified sport on the planet was sloughing. Competitive slothers hung upside down from vines and tendrils until one, the loser, fell. The agony of defeat. Professional slothing was a mania on Busby, and it was the time for the Sloth Cup. No question that the stadium would be jammed. It could hold 72,000 Busbians comfortably. It had 100 dispensing counters and 600 food givers who roamed the stands handing out traditional Busbian delicacies. The stadium was equipped with its own gathering tanks. Busbians never had to leave their seats to remain productive. Bradford Thomas came up with a commercial that would show Cookie Fountain against this backdrop. Shots of Busbians bulging and breathing hard in their excitement, stuffing themselves in perpetual input, struggling to applaud the victors with fat arms, would counterpoint Cookie Fountain's amazing grace. She was lightness itself, beautifully curved yet delicate as a web. It was almost as if she were a radiant hologram with form but no weight. Wide shot of Busbians waddling to stadium. High angle shot of Cookie in bikini. Cookie. From up here, Busby Stadium looks pretty, but down there, it's a bowl of lard. Medium shots of Busbians gorging. Cookie. No, I don't know about you guys, but I'm glad I come from a place where you can get slendorable and stay adorable. Medium shots of sloth players hanging from vines. Cookie. Now I've got plenty of hang-ups, but that isn't one of them. Thanks to implodes Sendorable logo over picture. Cookie. So it's Buzz Me, not Busby, with Slendorable. Cookie sitting on rock, faces camera. Around her, fat Busby and children play Ring Around the Rosie. Cookie. On the planet Busby, this is Cookie Fountain saying Slenderize with Slendorable, cause fat's deplorable. Sloth player falls from vine to plop sound effect. On the final night of the trip to Busby, Bradford Thomas looked over his copy. It was masterful. It would create a real sensation around the galaxy. Thrust Associates had promised that the team would be defended by the best lawyers against any litigation, should it come to that. At worst, the team could expect a fine, which the agency would gladly pay, or a few days in jail, measured against the attendant publicity and reward. It was worth it to do the first commercial from a forbidden planet. Slendorable Inc. had agreed to the bargain to purchase 1,000 shares of stock in Bradford Thomas's name. It was a terrific stock. As Slendorable sold, the stock grew obese with profit. After this campaign, it would go through the roof. With his share of the pie, Bradford Thomas could afford finally to resign from his 9-to-5 job. He could become a consultant if necessary. But his real ambition was to write novels. Now he would have the wherewithal to do that. He thought of himself sitting by the sea or at the tip of a lake, writing slowly and carefully, probing for the word, in tune with himself, with nature, with all creation. He had worked in advertising for 15 years, waiting for the chance to escape with sufficient velocity to achieve his own orbit. Now that the moment had come, he vowed not to blow it. Every step in the strategy of achievement had been gone over again and again, from the landing on Busby, to smuggling the camera and film, to setting up, to bribing innocent Busbian kiddies with rainbow-covered candies, to disguising Cookie Fields and the crew in fat suits that inflated like balloons, to returning quickly to the transport and remaining hidden in a false vat built to contain Busby Grow. Once the ship had left Busby, the rest was a clear sail. The commercial would be edited aboard and ready to show in the Ms. Dipper pageant, the most watched program in the star system, banned on Busby. Thinking on the future, the irony of things did not escape Bradford Thomas. In truth, his lifestyle was not too different from that of the average Busbian. Working in advertising, writing hymns of praise to products, most of which were unnecessary or defective, then using the money he was paid for rent, food, and such creature comforts as he enjoyed. Like any Busbian, Bradford Thomas lived off his droppings. The few stories he had submitted for publication, and his one attempt at a novel, had been quickly rejected. It was not his art they wanted. It was his feces. What Busbians accomplished with their rear ends, he accomplished with his head. Now, the commercial for Slendorable would allow him to wallow in beauty, to live out his days writing as he wished, and so much the better if his work found an audience. Life is mysterious and full of surprise. Bradford Thomas's mother used to say that, and how right she was. Patient, son, she would say, it will come to you in time. Because she had died of anorexia, Bradford Thomas's had qualms about working for Slendorable, Inc., even indirectly, but he knew his mother would have approved of his decision. She was romantic, but practical. Her fatal diet had been aimed at keeping Bradford Thomas's father at home, since he had an eye for ladies who looked like Cookie Fountain, or tried to. His mother practically disappeared before Bradford Thomas's very eyes. But what she lost in weight, she gained in wisdom and never lost her optimism. Patient, son, it will come to you in time. When her time came, she weighed less than their dog. She was transparent in places and made remarks about her son being able to see through her. At least the end was peaceful. A wind lifted her like a leaf and dropped her far out in the Atlantic off East Hampton Beach. But her faith remained with Bradford Thomas, along with her belief in literature. Cookie Fountain came to Bradford Thomas's quarters at midnight. She wore a robe of gold mesh and high-heeled shoes. "I'm very tense," she said. "I always get that way before a major shoot. Suppose we're spotted. Suppose they know what we're up to at Savage, Gossamer, and Levine. Then what?" "Be calm," Bradford Thomas said. "Nothing will go wrong. Suppose that when we're hiding in the vat, they make a mistake and pump it full of Busby balls. What a way to die." "You're not going to die, darling. You're going to be even more famous than you are now." "Are you sure, Brad? Are you definite?" "Absolutely, Cookie. What were you thinking about? Revisions?" "I was thinking about my mother, rest her soul." "Oh, I didn't mean to interrupt. Oh, Brad, I can't sleep. I can't. I'm an ugly, terrible creature." Bradford Thomas reached out to comfort her. A few hours from touchdown, he made love to a former Ms. Dipper. Holding her in his arms, careful not to squash her in passion, he smiled to himself. Sometimes things go well. Not often, sometimes. The shoot went well. The commercial was an astonishing success. Bradford Thomas's 1,000 shares of Slendorable, Inc. split again like healthy cells and made him rich beyond his dreams. He bought a house in East Hampton and spent his days watching the ocean and writing a flood of stories, poems, and novels that exposed the human condition. After threatening all kinds of legal action, Savage, Gossamer, and Levine withdrew all complaint in the face of Slendorable's triumph and public reaction. Then they offered Bradford Thomas a job as supervisor of concept transformation, and he could turn it down with a flourish. He even found a publisher, a small, obscure house, but a publisher. He agreed quietly to subsidize the printing of his own work when the publisher teetered on the verge of bankruptcy. But why not? His books got no review space, but he knew that they would. Patience, time. He quietly arranged for his publisher to contract for full pages of advertising he himself had written. When the ads were placed and paid for, he would get his reviews. All fields need fertilizing. Sure enough, one day his publisher called, "Brad, I have incredible news. You sold a copy in Texas? Better. Your books are taking off like hotcakes." "Curious. I can't even find them in the bookstores. I once found one behind a hedonesque romance under an International Enquirer, but that's it." "Not here, Brad. Not on Earth. You know how many writers were discovered first on other planets?" "Oh, well, tell me, where?" "On Busby. They love your stuff on Busby." Bradford Thomas looked out at the sea, then up at the sky, and suddenly believed in God the Architect. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.